of the news you're not supposed to know. I want to start today with some information from Portland Cop Watch, and then I want to talk about the cult of Trump and the cult of whiteness. And if I have time, I'd like to invite your calls. But first, Portland Cop Watch has put out comments on the crowd control directive of the Portland Police Department in a letter addressed to Chief Outlaw, Portland Police Bureau, Department of Justice, and others. They write, in September 2017, Portland Cop Watch issued a six-page analysis of the changes made to the Bureau's crowd management and crowd control directive, which went into effect in late August. They write, we noted in a footnote at the time that despite changes stating impact and aerosol weapons were not to be used indiscriminately against crowds, such weapons were used on September 10th, when the directive was theoretically formal policy. Thankfully, they write, we have not heard of any such police attacks on the students walking out to protest gun violence yesterday on the 14th. This points to one of the overall concerning issues with the process of asking the community for input into Bureau policies. Even when changes are made that we can support, there needs to be evidence that they are being enforced and that officers are being held accountable for violating them. Now, I want to skip ahead in the report. Section 8.2.2 explicitly calls for officers using the loudspeaker system to communicate targeted information to specific individuals to provide direction. We noted this is an intimidating tactic coming from the military-grade long-range acoustic device, LRAD, now in use, and asked the Bureau to stop it. Instead, the policy formalized the ability. This deserves much more discussion, as police will call out the names of people they know, but say, you in the red sweatshirt to others, creating, shall we say, unequal protection of the law. See 14th Amendment. Now, I want to depart from what was written there and do an explanation. The LRAD, the long-range acoustic device, has a setting that allows one person to be targeted, receiving a message that is essentially private and so intimate that it can be confused with audio delusions. It uses sound diffraction to achieve that effect. Of course, if you're hearing voices right now, it likely isn't the LRAD. But Portland Cop Watch recommended a policy against targeting those observing police at demonstrations. Section 12.4, they write, prohibits arresting media or legal observers solely for their role in observing, capturing, and/or reporting on demonstrations of events or events. The Bureau put in two caveats, though. One is that those observing must do so in a safe manner and in compliance with police orders, and the other says that if observers do not comply with all police orders, they may be arrested. And they write, we're not sure this is contemplated by the First Amendment. And again, I want to comment, obviously not. Obviously, directions addressed at the crowd will not necessarily apply to observers and media. For example, if I am observing and recording a demonstration for KBOO, as I have often done, and I'm standing on a media across from a sidewalk. If the police tell everyone to get on the sidewalk and out of the street and then arrest me for being on the median, then that would obviously be a violation of the First Amendment. Returning to the text, Portland Cop Watch asked that video not be taken for situational awareness and turned over to the city attorney because ORS 181A.250 prohibits collecting or maintaining information on people's social, political, or religious affiliations without reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. Section 4.3 now allows live video feeds which are not permitted to be recorded without such suspicion being authorized by the incident commander. The policy explicitly says the authorization cannot be based on monitoring the associations and views of the people. However, the fact that a live video is being transmitted still seems to fall under the idea of collecting information whether or not it is retained. Portland Cop Watch writes, the Bureau did not act to prohibit the use of violent arrests, as we asked, leaving in place a requirement to consider the method of the arrest. Moreover, the PPB did not make changes such as adding a level of criminal behavior and likelihood of escalating tensions to the existing consideration of timing, location, and method of arrest. There was no response, they write, to our concern that multiple uses of force against the crowds are not being reflected in quarterly force reports. They write, we learned that crowd force incidents are being consolidated in a separate section at the end of the annual use of force data reports, but not integrated with the other data. Officer-involved shootings are also not included with the general totals. We have asked before and ask again, why is force against a protester not counted as force? Section 8, on announcements, does not require officers to ensure that conflicting commands such as get off the street onto the sidewalk, get off the sidewalk into the street are not given. The closest the directive comes is saying the incident commander has to ensure announcements are consistent, which could just mean they are ongoing. Section 9.2.1 says that weapons cannot be used unless there is an escape route available to the crowd. Such an escape route, however, is not required when officers order a dispersal, and there is no requirement that those giving orders to the crowd be aware of such an escape route. The Bureau took out the words contain and control as goals of police tactics, highlighting the idea of de-escalation instead. However, the directive adds the terms protect public safety and restore peace and order at the beginning and end of that section, bringing the same problem of vagueness which could lead to over-policing based on a subjective interpretation. Moreover, they write, the entire directive's tone is set by Procedure Section 1, talking about how Directive 1010.0 on use of force, governor's officer use of force. Directive 1010.0 itself begins with a section on de-escalation. That should be noted before the words use of force are used in this directive. Portland Cop Watch writes, the use of deadly force has not been prohibited in Section 10. Despite suggestions from Portland Cop Watch, the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, and Oregon Lawyers for Good Government, nor has the Bureau prohibited the use of, quote, batons, pepper spray, impact munitions, flash bangs, tear gas, and bicycles, end quote, as we asked. And that's the end of the quoted passages. And these are just the most pressing issues. And the missive goes on to discuss other problems, such as the fact that the PPB has not sworn off kettling tactics in which protesters are effectively caged and then arrested en masse. These observations will become increasingly important. And I think as people realize exactly what Trump intends to do, I think there will be more protests. And it's a good thing that Portland Cop Watch is out there doing their thing. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You can pick up the broadcast on live video on Periscope. That's available on Twitter at KBOO Press Watch. And you can also find it live on Facebook right now under Teresa Mitchell. But as I said, this is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, other frequencies elsewhere, and KBOO.FM. Now I want to talk about the totalitarianism that we are experiencing under Trump. Trump has been called a fascist and a dictator. And these words harken back to the horrors that were experienced in the 20th century. And they apply in some ways. I want to dial down on exactly what Trump is doing in this 21st century context. Trump's brand of totalitarianism is a 21st century phenomenon that draws from many sources, but in total hasn't been seen before. We need to understand this in order to break it and destroy its influence. There are several aspects, but it may be helpful to view it as a cult of racism and toxic masculinity that is promoted and enforced via social media, in part. It's also enforced via Fox News. I use the word cult advisedly here. Trump's followers have been conditioned, like all cult members, to accept increasingly deranged ideas in order to force them into the Trump worldview and away from normality. Allow me to elaborate. When you first join a cult, it doesn't seem so weird. The cult may offer you certain aspects of life, even if it's just a smile and a hug, a steady job, lodging, or even sex that have seemed unattainable to you. As an acolyte, you are drawn in by the promises, some of which may, at first, actually become reality. To keep you in the cult, it is necessary to tell you increasingly bizarre lies, and to get you in the group to repeat them and believe them. This has two main effects. It drives you away from mainstream society, where your cult lies create confusion and dismay. And it makes you feel like your only true refuge is in the cult that promotes the lies. In other words, where your new normality is accepted and understood and encouraged. In this way, pardon me, you are encouraged to turn against your own family and friends, and then it can be seen that their incomprehension and hostility proves the point of the cult, that theirs was the only true way in the first place. The more bizarre and unprovable these assertions are, the better their effect. In the case of the Trump administration, there are several, some unique and others drawn for drawn from long traditions of racism and toxic masculinity, sexism, homophobia, etc. Trump supporters are encouraged to tell each other that President Obama was an insurgent Muslim and that he was not born in the United States. This also has the effect of identifying an enemy. Very important to the sort of cult. The fact that this lie is scoffed at and dismissed out of hand, proven otherwise, adds to its power. Add to the lie that the idea that homophobia is a moral stance rather than a pattern of male supremacist aggression. Add the assertion that entire races and populations are essentially criminal and must be excluded with, say, a multi-billion-dollar wall. Add the demonstration that women are properly commodities to be herded, harassed, and preyed upon by alpha male billionaires. Add the constant gestures of disdain and violence towards all people not viewed as white, like Muslim exclusion and rejection of the most peaceful gestures of protest at the NFL games, implying that whiteness is superiority. All of these ideas create hostility to the Trump camp at the same time as they please and promote the resentments that dim-witted Trump supporters suffer from. And here I am not being insulting. I'm just trying to say that this is the phenomenon that we observe, and it is the dim-wittedness of the Trump supporters that is being preyed upon here as much as anything else. And one might ask, what is the responsibility of a thinking person towards a dim-witted person? What is the responsibility of a thinking person towards a stupid person? The responsibility is one of stewardship, however obnoxious that might be viewed by those who cannot think clearly. There is no honor in aggression towards the stupid. To understand the construction of these resentments, one must deconstruct patriarchalist whiteness. A big part of whiteness is the definition of the self using microaggressions. Microaggressions can take the form of ignoring people of color, denigrating femininity, mocking the accent of non-native English speakers, appropriating phrases and gestures of non-white groups, defending, insulting sports mascots, etc. The pitiful thing about whiteness, pardon me, is that it creates a psyche that defines itself according to these little gestures of imagined racial superiority. So you see how the Trump whiteness cult is set up. So my fellow white people, not only are you defined by the fraud of the idea of a white race itself, but you must construct a separate self that depends on a set of smirking put-downs. And that gets so much into the psyche, and I know this because I am part of this, so much into the psyche that it creates a sense of alarm when it is confronted. If you have no access as a white person to all of these smirking put-downs, to all of these microaggressions, if you confront them all, then you create a vacuum. You have to ask yourself, well, who am I if I am not this person who is in opposition to non-whiteness? The mind abhors a vacuum, and Trump supporters are thrilled when Trump signals that they can relax from the work of cleansing their minds of racial aggression and toxic masculinity, and that the frightening change is over, and they can go back to their usual habits of putting down women and people of color. But they also know that people who define themselves as liberal are also white supremacists, but they won't admit it. There is a power there. It's obvious in every microaggression and in the resentment liberals feel when they are called out on microaggressions. Whiteness is cheap. It is a cheap, unsatisfying, and flimsy ripoff of an identity. Actually, it's just a social status. But it's all that unreconstructed white people have. If you want to destroy Trumpism, my fellow white people, you must first study, understand, confront, and dismantle whiteness. Study, understand, confront, and dismantle microaggressions. Dismantle whiteness within yourself. This is why I say for the world to live, whiteness must die. Trump has power over you to the extent that you allow whiteness to go on unconfronted in your own mind. Returning to the Trump social control phenomenon, these are cult tactics, and you will recognize them as elements of previous fascist and totalitarian movements. As a demagogue, Trump must fan the flames of shunning, hatred, and resentment. So by gesture, he pretends that people like me, transgender that is, are a danger to the efficient operation of the armed forces. That's just for example. And again, it has two effects. It pleases the Trump victims who believe that they are superior to transgender persons and who wish to punish transgender persons and by extension punish all femininity. And it confuses and angers the greater community who in the past decade have taken pains to understand that transgender people are a natural and historic part of the greater spectrum of humanity and who view attacks on transgender persons as cowardly and venal. Trump has said that he likes conflict. In fact, his brand depends on conflict, on us versus them mentality. Transgender people are a great target, as they do not have sufficient numbers or resources to defend themselves against Trumpism. Now, we'll talk about totalitarianism generally. We are under totalitarianism, and the majority of the population is. If you are a white male, you might object and say, wait, this isn't totalitarianism. I still have some freedoms. I can walk down the street, and I can speak my mind, and I can be myself. And this is true for white males. However, that is a minority of the population. That is less than 25% of the population, I do believe, or close to that. The rest of us are women, are not male identified, are not white. And so this is minority rule that we see being projected by the Trump administration, and it certainly just follows on minority rule that has been the fact in the United States for all these years. For me, persons like me, persons who, for whatever reason, are targeted by this sort of mindset, this is a totalitarian country. I could make an imaginary border 100 miles east of here and draw a line from there to Philadelphia, where the first thing I confronted when I got off the plane was when I was there for the Democratic Convention in 16, was a person working for the local transit authority who immediately and loudly misgendered me. A line extending from here to the East Coast, let's say, though, where I will simply not be safe walking down Main Street in broad daylight. That's just the fact. If you can't walk down Main Street in broad daylight, you're not living in a free country, and I don't. So the toxic Trump cult tells lies to create a loyal minority apartheid-style base to operate from. Trump is not going for majority rule. When Trump says or implies that white men are superior, it is, of course, inflammatory to the whole world, except to his loyal base, which is disproportionately centered in the military. It pleases his militaristic minority base, and that's the idea. The cultists are rewarded with the smug idea that they are close to the center of power, and everyone else is wrong-footed by this. This is a horrible way to run a country, but it is working for Trump for now. We see by his Twitter decrees that he intends to continue ruling by fiat. The man uses Twitter not only to attack his opponents, but simply to conduct the business of his administration in purposeful arrogance and coldness against the very people that he is supposed to be leading. He fired Rex Tillerson, for example, internationally by Twitter. That was the first Tillerson knew about it. Dissect a Trump tweet, however, and you will see that there is almost always an inflammatory element, an unfair accusation or insult that accompanies the main message. This is intended to enrage. It is a cheap tactic employed by a bully so that the main message cannot be addressed until the insult is also addressed. It forces responders to deal with a multifaceted attack rather than a statement or a single issue. It can't simply be reasoned or argued with as a debating point because it contains multiple points. Persons who are accustomed to being respectful and fair and their debating tactics are put off their balance right away by this sort of thing, trying to decide which point to address and whether to address both or several points. Trump's tweets are each an act of aggression, and they make his supporters grin with fascist glee as they see less corrupt people try to deal with them. Trump supporters love those toxic tweets and their multiple insinuations. Perhaps you know someone who is a bully and speaks in that manner, throwing in a lying or inflammatory insinuation in each sentence. Such people are hated, feared, and avoided. We cannot avoid Trump's tweets, so we must learn to counter them directly by saying, that's an insult, a lying insinuation, and a statement. So here's why the statement is false. Here's why the insult is false. And here is why the lying insinuation is false. As in the case of dealing with a toxic person directly, we must call out all of the aggression directly. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Trump's concern at this point is not so much to grow the numbers of his cult as to consolidate his power. So, for example, when he went to California this week, he ignored the fact that California overwhelmingly rejected his presidency. He went to military bases where he finds a cheering base for his toxic masculinity brand. He promised them more power. And it would appear that he is poised to deliver on that in terms of military confrontations. He is moving to escalate the wars in Syria and Afghanistan, confront Iran, and bomb Korea. On that last point, one might think that history is taking another direction because there are talks upcoming. I wish that that were true. But in the case of the supposedly upcoming summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un, I see no possible good outcome. The reason is that both leaders are going into negotiations in bad faith. In the case of Kim Jong-un, the meeting is part of a long delineated fantasy script, literally the script of a popular North Korean movie, which has been out for years, in which the dear leader proves so canny and fierce in his preparations that even the mighty U.S. president is forced to humbly come to the table to ask for mercy and retract his aggressions. And of course, Trump is a coarse narcissist who desires to show that he has bullied the little rocket man, as he calls him, to beg for mercy at the bar of nuclear obliteration. Of course, neither of these men are going to beg for mercy. And both are going to leave the meeting frustrated and angry. Both will then say that the ultimate and final efforts have been made to avoid war. And both will feel justified in striking. Trump has been wooing John Bolton, the farmer ambassador to the UN under the Bush, the lesser administration. Bolton is a walking embodiment of warmongering. Present Bolton with a problem, and Bolton will say that the solution is war. I can't find any exceptions to that over decades. Trump has had Bolton over to the White House recently in what has been described as a job interview. After Trump saw him several times on the television, bloviating about the glory of war, and Trump is, of course, disproportionately affected by television. That's what he watches. That's his source of information. He likes to watch Fox News, and Bolton has been on there. Trump recently replaced Rex Tillerson, who had warned against the dangers of going to war with North Korea, with a more compliant CIA director, Pompeo, who thinks it's a peachy idea. Now we may be seeing H.R. McMaster, the advisor H.R. McMaster in the White House, replaced with Bolton, who recently wrote, quote, "It is perfectly legitimate for the United States to respond to the current necessity posed by North Korea's nuclear weapons by striking first," end quote. Consolidation of Trump apartheid rule is not going to be successful without a major war. I think Trump knows this. Bush did. This war must be stopped unless we are willing to concede all human progress for a generation. The crisis produced by this gigantic military confrontation will define our lives and force us all under the thrall of Trump fascism. Nothing he wants will be questioned if a war this big is underway. I can't emphasize that enough. Choose freedom. Stop this war. As a preview of what we can expect under the Trump War Administration, we can look to Betsy DeVos' brother, Eric Prince. The Intercept first reported that Prince, the billionaire heir and former commander of the Blackwater Mercenaries, was in thick with the Trump administration from the start. Bloomberg reports Prince had a role with the Trump transition and was tasked with approaching private sector for hires. He had a backdoor entrance at the Trump Tower. Prince recently traveled to the Seychelles Islands to meet with Saudi Prince, Mohammed bin, I can't remember his last name, we'll just say MBZ, and a Russian envoy for Putin. Prince had set up mercs for MBZ previously. Prince was asked about that in a hearing and then lied to Congress about the meeting, saying nothing much was discussed, but it has come out since in statements by Mueller target George Nader that the meeting did establish a Russian back channel, what Kushner wanted. Prince was overheard on a D.C. train talking about the reorganization of the entire U.S. security apparatus, and we know from Trump's actions in the past that such a reorganization would be to create a new national security oversight that would be loyal to Trump personally. And we know from Prince's statements about how good the Phoenix program was that this would be a Trump death squad. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Now I turn to article in The Intercept by Matthew Cole and Jeremy Scahill published last December, the Trump administration is considering a set of proposals developed by Blackwater founder Eric Prince and a retired CIA officer with assistance from Oliver North, a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, to provide CIA Director Mike Pompeo and the White House with a global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies, according to several current and former U.S. intelligence officials and others familiar with the proposals. The sources say the plans have been pitched to the White House as a means of countering deep state enemies in the intelligence community seeking to undermine Donald Trump's presidency. And as I was saying previous to this, or rather as I was saying previously on this program, Pompeo is now in, and a notorious torturer is in charge of the CIA, and Pompeo, the warmonger, is now under the wing of the Trump administration. The creation, they write, of such a program raises the possibility that the effort would be used to create an intelligence apparatus to justify the Trump administration's political agenda. Quote, Pompeo can't trust the CIA bureaucracy, so we need to create this thing that reports just directly to him, end quote. And that's according to a former senior U.S. intelligence official with firsthand knowledge of the proposals in describing White House discussions. Also quoting, it is a direct action arm, totally off the books. The whole point is this is supposed to report to the president and Pompeo directly, end quote. And this is meaning that the intelligence collected would not be shared with the rest of the CIA or the larger intelligence community. And speaking for myself, now that now that Pompeo is in the White House, this seems ever more likely, and given the recent revelations about Prince. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You can find this video broadcast now archived on Periscope by looking on Twitter for at KBOO Press Watch. And you can find it on Facebook, where it is now live and will be archived. It will also be archived on the KBOO website. That will take about 20 minutes. And we've been going out to you via KBOO 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and going out via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Makes a positive difference in all our lives. Thank you for supporting this effort to keep Portland vital and engaged. Thank you for keeping Portland radical, and thank you for supporting KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for keeping KBOO fierce, vital, and independent, accountable to no one but you, the community.
Thank you.
Thanks for supporting KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for donating to KBOO's Kickstarter to help make a city of media makers.
Thank you.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own words. We have an online tour, which features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at 50 Years of